Mrajuhtuden.
Mrajuhtuden.
Sober as sober. Sober. Sober as
welcome to the Anonymous Eskimo Project, a program devoted to bringing hope to those struggling with mental health issues and addiction. Through candid conversations with guests about mental health issues, addiction, and sobriety, we can let those who are struggling know that they are not alone. I am your host, Ralph Sara. On today's program, I have Marcia J. Thomason, Red Shawl Woman. Marcia is Tsilagi and Choctaw, who was born in Idaho but now resides in Fairbanks, Alaska. Marcia has been in recovery for 35 years, and today, Marcia courageously shares her story for those who are still struggling. So guys, please help me welcome Marcia J. Thomason. Hi, Marcia. How are you?
I'm really good. How are you?
I'm doing good. So I was on social media and I saw a post you had put up about sharing your story. And that was, I think, last week.
Yeah.
So you got up and shared your story. How did it go?
It was really good. It was kind of interesting. It was for pre-med students at Harvard, and they're looking at the benefits of telling your story and healing and how they're connected.
Wow, Harvard, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I was really, really surprised that they were getting that progressive.
Yeah, it's taken a while, huh?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Marcia, can you go ahead and introduce yourself so everybody can get to know you, please?
Yeah, metaki ape pi e machi ape ye tashina lutawin, Red Shawl Woman. And my English name is Marcia Jean Thomason Ose. And I'm the daughter of Beverly Phoenix Tsilagi of Oklahoma and Lauren Thomason Choctaw of Oklahoma.
Can you go ahead and kind of tell everyone what your life looked like before recovery?
Oh, gosh. Well, I was born in Idaho, and it was my parents' second marriage, and I don't really think they were prepared to be married. And they divorced when I was about three, and then my mom remarried, and at that point, she had married into a family where alcoholism was pretty prevalent. And at that point, my life really blew up. There was drinking all around me, substance use around me. All of a sudden, I had all these other siblings and grandparents. So there was a lot of chaos going on. My mom also drank while she was pregnant with me. And so there was some fetal alcohol effect going on. So it was just really a lot of chaos. We moved four times a year, every year, till I dropped out of high school when I was a sophomore in high school. So some of the things that I learned was, commitment doesn't really matter, and you can always run away from your problems, and substances work to change the way that you feel. So yeah, that was kind of what my life was like.
What are your, what are you recovering from?
Intravenous IV drug use, methamphetamines. I've been clean for 35 years off of methamphetamines. Really anything that I could get my hands on to shut my head off and feel like I could fit in. And I also have major depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and anxiety disorder, and a dissociative identity disorder. So I spent a lot of my life the second half of my life, I like to call it. I've spent a lot of that time in recovery, working on just integrating and finding out who I really am and what I really like and being me, as opposed to putting on a mask.
Now, was the process difficult? What inspired you to, you know, say, okay, I'm going to be sober now?
Well, I'll tell you, I was sitting on my house, at my house, and I had just injected some methamphetamine, and it didn't work. And I thought, oh my God, you know, if this doesn't work, then what? You know, and it was like the sense of abandonment. And I understood abandonment from all the different marriages. Both my parents were married 10 times each. So it wasn't, losing people wasn't that big of a deal, but losing the substance and it wasn't giving me the effect, I decided I didn't want to live. And so I attempted suicide, and that didn't work. So then I asked my partner if he would go to treatment with me, and he said no. So I thought, well, I'll just take myself out by myself. And I ended up leaving the home, and I lost time. I lost about 30 minutes and 30 miles. And when I came to, I was in front of the hospital where I had been born. And there was a guy setting up for a 12-step meeting. And at the time, I didn't know what that was. I just saw this guy carrying coffee pots in and out of a room. And I said, I really think I need help. And he says, yeah. He says, go in the front doors and go to the top floor. They can help you there. And I admitted myself into treatment. So for me, the bottom was not having my friend, my substance anymore. I couldn't imagine life with it.
Oh, wow.
Or without it.
You know, when you mentioned suicide, and we were just talking about the suicide walk, you know, I've had battles with that as well. And it's a prevalent thing in the Native community, and especially with people who are, you know, experiencing this type of life where substance abuse and alcohol are prevalent, you know?
Well, and I grew up with a family where obviously alcoholism was normal. Drugs were normal. And suicide had been very normalized in my family. My maternal grandmother, three of her older brothers had all committed suicide. And my grandmother always talked about it, and my mom always talked about it. So I was the house that I never brought. I mean, I never brought friends over to my house because I never knew what I was going to find when I got home from school. You know, if my mom like had her head in the oven, I didn't know, you know. And so that always seemed like the solution in my family was like, when it gets too rough, you can just take yourself out.
Yeah, and that's such a hard subject to talk about. It's kind of like a taboo subject, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, I learned a long time ago, if I was going to be in recovery, I had to stop worrying about taboos. I had to stop worrying about stigma, because everybody has a story. And I just needed to tell my story and encourage people around me to tell their story. And accept people for who they are.
Yes, definitely. So when you were, when you decided to tell your story, and like you were saying, you were telling your story to the Harvard community, is it like a, tell us the healing process or the healing feeling that you get from sharing?
Well, it was a little bit overwhelming because I'm used to telling my story, you know, in a 12-step meeting place. And so, and I've had sponsors, so you sort of know what you can share in a general way, what it used to be like, what it's like today, you know, your experience, strength, and hope. And I worked with one of the students and wrote my story out, what I was going to share, because I didn't want to go into glorifying, I didn't want to tell horror stories, but I did want them to understand that, many of their patients might have had the same life experience that I did, and they needed to find a place of compassion. So I was afraid at first. If so, first time I've ever spoken, got nauseous before I was going to speak.
Oh, no.
And then when it was over, it was like there was 124 people, you know, on the call, and they were so accepting, and there were so many people that identified with the things that I was talking about. And, you know, one of the questions was how do you get good health care? And I talked about how you have to learn how to advocate for yourself and tell the truth about who you are, and interview the doctor first before accepting them to be your caregiver. Because if it's somebody that's going to be dismissive, or if you're just too much, they don't have the skill to work with somebody with, you know, co-occurring disorders, then refer me to somebody else. So it ended up being really positive.
Wow. I never would have thought of that right now, to tell you the truth. Interviewing your provider or your doctor, you know?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell them straight up because, you know, I've done a lot of damage to my body with the substance use and all the other things that I've mixed in there. So my body doesn't respond to traditional Western medicine real well. Like, I have a reverse my body does the opposite. So if you give me morphine, I get really, really wired, like I'm on an amphetamine. If you give me an amphetamine, it brings me down. If you give me a benzodiazepine, they just don't work in my body. And the same with my mental health medications. The old school classification of medications work for me, but the new ones don't. And so I have spent a lot of time working with doctors and trial and error. So I know my body really well. So when I have to go to a new doc, I'll give them the rent. I'll say, look, you got time to talk because you need to know who I am as a patient. And I'll explain things to them. And they're like, here's another weird thing about my body. It's like, I don't go through detox symptoms when I've been on a narcotic, like a pain medication. I've had my knees replaced and stuff. And they were very worried I was going to have some sort of adverse reaction. I said, no, my body doesn't react that way. But it's taken, 35 years for me to learn that about myself and some really good care providers that were willing to work with me.
Wow. You know, we, as Native people, we get, healthcare, free healthcare, basically. And to think about interviewing a provider or a doctor to fit your needs is kind of foreign, because you're like, in our tradition, you're like, you have to be humble, you have to be, accepting. To advocate for yourself is probably a foreign thought to many people, in the Indigenous community. Like, be grateful for what you get,
Yeah, well, that's okay. No, I'm not going to be grateful for what I can get. And, I work in reentry, so I work with folks that are coming home from prison. And one of the things that we do is we'll set up, doctor's appointments, and I'll sit with them and ask them, okay, what all do you want to know? What all have you done to yourself? What are your substances? And then I go with them and I walk them through how to advocate for themselves, even if they're at a Native clinic. Like in Fairbanks, we have Chief Andrew Isaac. And what's been really cool is that the care providers at Chief Andrew Isaac have been very open to people advocating for themselves and talking to them about what their needs are.
Wow. Yeah, that's, something that needs to be brought up. And I'm so glad that you're talking about it right now.
Yeah. Well, and I learned this, because I'm a substance abuse provider by trade. And I learned this from an elder, Myra Heaps, because I would ask my clients a question and they wouldn't answer right away. So then I'd ask another question. Then I'd ask another question. And they would say, well, which one do you want me to answer? The first one, the second one, or the third one? And so I went to Myra. She was Gwich'in from Fort Yukon. I said, okay, help me. She said, we like to stop and think about what we're going to talk about. You need to learn to sit quietly with your patient or your client and wait for the answer. And it may be 3 or 4 minutes. And that's really what we have to teach our care providers, is that you need to sit with them when you're asking them a question and let them answer you. Because we're, as Native people, we're very thoughtful about our words and what we say.
Wow. Yeah. I never thought of that, you know, when talking to elders and stuff like that, you know, they do take more time.
Yeah. And I was raised in a city, in a Western school system. I wasn't raised on a reservation, you know, around my tribes or anything. And it wasn't until I came to Alaska that I learned about cadence and timing and just holding sacred space with people.
Yeah, yeah. So do you see like a clinician or like a mental health clinician?
I do.
And I know that is a hard thing to talk about too, because, you know, Native people were taught not to talk about our, you know, our hardships or our things that are bothering us or things that are, you know, that hurt us, you know?
Right. I think that's part of why we haven't really been able to move beyond the, you know, multi-generational or intergenerational traumas, is because we haven't talked about it for so long. We just suck it up and, you know, just keep putting up fish and moose for the winter, you know, and pick and berry.
Yeah.
We don't take time. And if that's one gift I have from, you know, the Western culture, is that it is okay to talk about that stuff. Because once we start talking about it, it gives people permission to talk about their own and things, unhealthy, unacceptable behavior towards us will stop.
Mm-hmm. It took me how many times of treatment to really open up to somebody. And this last time in treatment, I finally did. And I'm, you know, 47 years old, and I finally like decided to talk. And let me tell you, it was, you know, an experience where it felt like weight was lifted off of me, you know, and that's ultimately why I decided to, you know, have people on. So it can be, you know, normalized to talk about things and talk about things that people are experiences. Maybe you can relate to somebody else's story, or you've heard that before, or something is similar to what you're going through, and, you know, maybe we could help each other navigate and heal.
Well, I think that was what was really interesting, is because I grew up, like I said, I went to the, on an average of 4 schools a year from first grade until 10th grade. We never stayed long, any place very long. I never really learned how to make friends or anything. And so I really struggled when I first got into the rooms, the 12-step meetings, because I didn't believe them. I didn't trust them. You know, I just couldn't believe that anybody was that like clean or sincere or authentic.
Mm.
And then I was sitting in a meeting, and there was a guy in the room with his family in this treatment center. You had to make amends before they would let you leave. And so he started making amends to his wife and his children, and he broke down and he was crying. And it was, and I had never seen a man show emotion before, unless it was anger,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, maybe. So I couldn't really relate to the people in the rooms, but I could relate to the stories in the back of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could find myself in those stories from those people from the 30s. The behaviors that they talked about. And it was like, oh, okay, I think I can do this.
Yeah.
But it took me probably 7 years before I actually told the truth to somebody as a sponsor, because I just didn't trust that they wouldn't gossip about me or hurt me with the information. I would just say I was fine, or I would listen to what other people said, and I would say what they said, but it wasn't really me. I wasn't really being truthful. And then I realized if I'm going to get better, I've got to tell the truth. Because that was another low point in recovery where I recognized there's a line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous where it talks about incomprehensible demoralization. And I, for me, incomprehensible demoralization is when you're doing the same thing sober that you used to blame on drugs or alcohol. So I didn't have anything to blame it on. This was just who I was, and this was my character. And I knew that wasn't going to cut it. And so I finally started to get honest.
And getting honest with yourself brings out a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I knew my truth, but I wasn't going to tell it to anybody else.
Right?
I told, and then, oh, I did the funniest thing. I had a therapist, and I wasn't going to tell this dude nothing because he was going to write it down and report it to somebody I knew. I just knew that was what he was going to do. So I would send, I lived in another city and I had to drive to where he was. So I would write out postcards. I wouldn't address them or put a, you know, anything that was identifying it as me of some dastardly deed that I had done. And I would mail them to him. And then I would, when I would go into his office, I would wait to see if he said any, you know, said anything, or if he was going to say, I'm sorry, I can't help you or whatever. And he never said nothing. And then I had worked with him for like 17 years. And he told me, well, you know, I'm going to retire. I'm like, you're going to retire. You're going to leave me. And he opened a drawer and he pulled out all those postcards I had sent him all those years ago. He goes, well, you sent me all these and I didn't leave you. And I'm like, how did you know it was me? He said, well, because they came from McCall and you're the only client I had from that part of Idaho.
Oh.
But I thought I was being so sneaky.
Wow. Man. And you know, that goes for, you know, seeing a clinician too, when you talked about advocating yourself, you know, and maybe that's why I didn't open up. You know, for so long, because maybe I didn't trust somebody or whatever. And, you know, this last clinician that I'm seeing right now, actually, I saw her in treatment, and now I'm seeing her outside of treatment, was just a person that I had so much, I felt it, you know, I felt the trust and I felt the, you know, like the helping, you know, almost like love, you know?
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing I do too, is like, if they're looking at their clock, if they're not looking at me when I'm talking to them, I fire them. I go find somebody else.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Even if you're going to be in the room with me 30 minutes as a doctor or an hour, I want to be number one priority to you.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And maybe it was too, because instead of talking the whole time or something like that, she'd listen. She's like a really good listener, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So how would you encourage somebody that's, you know, struggling? What would you say to someone who is currently struggling?
Well, first I would talk to them. I'd ask them if they'd be willing to talk to me about what they've tried. So we kind of know what they've done. And then I, you know, like, what about that list worked? What didn't work? And then I would ask them, what are you open to try? You know, I think recovery is really about exploration of connection, finding where you connect, where you can plug in and hear what you need to hear, where you can, like, you can't force a three-pronged plug into a two-prong wall unit. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's going to be different. And it's, you can't run everybody through treatment and expect that everybody's going to get it. So I would say find somebody that is willing to explore with you, challenge you, but not in a harmful way. And try new things. Because you don't know what you don't know until you try it.
Mm-hmm. Marcia, in your 35 years of recovery, what's the most important thing that you have learned?
Oh my gosh, that I make a difference, that I matter, that I have a purpose. What I thought my purpose was is not what my purpose is, if that makes any sense at all. I just figured I was gonna be like my grandma and just, you know, die young. And I've learned that the universe, Tinkashala, God, Jesus, whatever word you want to put on your higher power, has everything laid out. And I just have to get out of the way and just follow the lead. If a door doesn't open, I don't try to force it open. If a window slams shut, I don't try to open it. I go the past least resistance. I know I'm following God's path if I'm not running into roadblocks.
Well, Marcia, is there any other thing that you'd like to talk about or put out into the universe before we end this?
Well, I'll tell you this story. So I started in college 31 years ago, 32, actually, 32 years ago, and I couldn't do math. And I kept going and trying. I tried 5 different times. And I was getting ready to just say, to heck with it. I had like 260 credits. And I was like, you know what? F it. I'm not going to do this. I don't need a degree. I'm almost ready to retire. I've worked my whole life without one. And a friend of mine says, no, we're going to write a letter to the disability department. So we went through the whole process. So I asked somebody for help, right? And I let them help me. And UAF granted me a waiver. And so after 31 years, I was able to graduate from college with an associate's and a bachelor's and 3 minors. And it was because I just didn't give up. And I talked about it, and I let people help me. And I talked about my, you know, having fetal alcohol effect. I talked about my trauma. And I ended up being the UAF commencement speaker for the class of 2023 last month.
Wow.
And I never would have ever saw that for myself when I was that little girl hiding in the barn, you know, taking sips of whiskey. Mm. So if I could say anything, it's like, no matter what, don't give up, ask for help, and talk about what's blocking you from getting that help. If it's anxiety, if it's trauma, if it's whatever it is, find that one person that you know will meet you with unconditional positive regard and tell them your story.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. You're welcome.
Well, that's all for today's show. I hope you, the listeners, found some inspiration, strength, and hope. Listen next week when I have another strong, courageous person who is walking with us on this healing journey. I'm your host, Ralph Sara. Biura!
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.